from Shroud University. This is Russ Brialde bringing you another podcast on the Shroud of Turin, the greatest mystery in the known world.
Hey, good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. The techniques used in 1988 by three separate teams of scientists to date the Shroud of Turin back to the Middle Ages may have been inconclusive, a radiocarbon dating expert at Oxford University has told the BBC. Joining me right now to help me figure out if anything new is here or not is Russ Brialde, president and founder of the Shroud of Turin Education Project. He's been researching and lecturing on the Shroud for over 20 years. And it's good to have you with me, Russ. Thanks.
Well, thank you, Al. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, this carbon dating of the Shroud has been challenged, for a while now. Is there anything new that makes this story different than what, we've known for the last 10 years or so?
Well, I think the new part of the story really started in 2005 with the publication in a peer-reviewed journal by chemist Ray Rogers, who pretty much proved that corner that was cut for carbon-14 dating was some kind of a medieval reweave, because he was able to obtain thread samples from that corner and then thread samples from the main body of the Shroud, and lo and behold, they are entirely different. And so this was what really opened Pandora's box, and I think the news that is coming out now, kind of as a consequence of this new documentary that's being produced by the BBC. They interviewed Mr. Christopher Bronk Ramsey, who is the director of the Oxford Radiocarbon Dating Lab, one of the three labs that was involved in the 1988 carbon dating. And this is the first time that anyone involved with these labs has actually admitted that they might have made a mistake. In fact, that is a quote that you will hear on the documentary. He says, quote, "Perhaps we made a mistake," unquote. This is the first time that there's been any kind of movement in this kind of united front in terms of standing firm on their results, and they finally acknowledge that we might have made a mistake here.
So the mistake would have been having a bad sample?
Yeah.
Or was the problem in the radiocarbon dating itself?
Now, I don't think anyone really challenges radiocarbon dating per se. It's just the fact that you had a protocol that was established in 1985, and all the scientists had agreed to it, that they were going to cut from three different locations on the cloth. Instead, it was limited to one location and from one of the worst possible locations that you could select, the outside corner edge of the cloth, exactly where it had been held and handled hundreds of times over the centuries. And so this was an area that any archaeologist who uses carbon-14 dating would have avoided as much as possible, and yet that was the corner that was selected. And so now you have the most significant carbon dating test of the 20th century hinging on one questionable sample. That is the real problem.
Yeah, does it strike you as strange that you would have three teams, separate teams of scientists, working on this? They have to understand, or at least somebody understood, that this was a big deal. This was going to affect many people. Why would they be so careless? I mean, when experts do something that I think I would avoid, I'm suspicious that I've misunderstood what's going on.
Yeah, I think. I can't lay the blame entirely at their feet. I think that they saw, they were there when the sample was cut. It appeared on the surface that they were taking a sample from the original Shroud material. They did not go in and do real textile analysis to make sure that it was fully representative. I think they just assumed that it was. Mm-hmm. The scientific advisor to the diocese in Turin, He was the one that really made the decision to limit the sampling from three sample sites to one, and the Carbon Lab just said, okay, we'll test whatever you give us. And so it really wasn't a carbon dating lab decision in terms of where to cut the sample. But, you know, they could have easily voiced their opposition and said, no, we don't really think that's a great idea to take only one sample or to take it from that location. Instead, I think that they were just silent and said, they took what was given to them and dated it. And and it turned out to be a horrible decision.
What has developed in Shroud Research over the last 15, 20 years that leads you to believe that the Shroud is the authentic burial cloth of Christ?
Well, you know, with the Shroudishian Research Project and the results that came out in 1981, that was pretty conclusive right there that the Shroud was not the work of an artist. There is no ink, paint, dye, pigmentation, stain. There are no artistic substances on the cloth to account for the image. The blood chemistry was done, and it is human blood from actual wounds. And you will find that the blood chemistry indicates that the blood patterns is, in fact, the exudate from actual wounds, even with the evidence of gravity showing that many of those wounds occurred in the upright standing position. And then the man was dead because the blood flow from the side wound, the blood flow across the back is clearly post-mortem blood flow. These are all well-established facts. I think the new development that has come out in terms of understanding the nature of the image is that understanding why the image shows up on that cloth. And it's, again, not the result of substances applied to it, but there appears to be a very micro-thin layer of carbohydrates that exist on the surface of all the threads. This is a natural process as a result of the way the cloth is actually prepared when it is soaked in like a bleach and a soapworth solution. Anyways, it's kind of complex, but the bottom line is that something has interacted with this carbohydrate layer that is less than one-tenth the diameter of a human hair, and that's why the image appears. And this is some of the more recent chemistry that has come out in the past 5 years or so.
Russ, I appreciate you joining me and filling us in. And
you know, for your viewers who want to learn more, they can go to shrouduniversity.com.
Okay, well, can you stay with us for another segment?
Sure.
Okay, hang. We'll come back in just a moment. Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. With me, Russ Briault, president and founder of the Shroud of Turin Education Project. Russ, you were mentioning the shrouduniversity.com.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us more about it.
Well, this is a website that is, for students and students of all ages who want to do do a research paper, a project, a presentation, or who just want to investigate the mystery on their own. And what it does is that it takes the subject of the Shroud and breaks it down into 10 academic schools. So you have the School of Medicine, the School of Art, the School of Chemistry, School of Physics, and so on. And plus, the other thing that it does, it makes a lot of use of streaming audio, streaming media, podcasts. So we're trying to develop a site that is very user friendly to today's generation. So that's what Shroud University is all about.
So the people can go to that site then, and in roughly a dozen disciplines.
I have it broken down into 10 schools.
10 schools. So they can do research on the Shroud and medicine, the Shroud and botany.
Yes, exactly. There's all different disciplines that have been applied to the Shroud to unravel its incredible mystery. And it's just an interesting way to kind of divide this up. And So the you know, you asked me before the break if there's any new developments. The other thing that I think that is important in terms of historical research is that any student of history, there is a cloth with an image on it that was believed to be the burial shroud of Christ that disappeared from Constantinople in 1204. And then you have the current shroud, which we know today as the Shroud of Turin, that for the first time in Western Europe appears in France in 1356. So between 1204 and 1356, you have this 150-year gap where we really don't know exactly where the shroud was, and this has given reason for the detractors of the shroud to suggest that, aha, whatever turned up in Lirey, France in 1356 must be some kind of a medieval artwork, some kind of medieval fraud of some kind. So the challenge of historians has always been able to try to, can we link what disappeared from Constantinople in 1204, can we prove that that's the same thing that turned up in Turin, I mean, in Lirey, France in 1356? And in 1993, we discovered a document called the Hungarian Prey Manuscript. This was the out-of-the-park home run that clearly linked the two documents, proving absolutely that what disappeared during the Fourth Crusade in 1204 is exactly what showed up in Lirey, France in 1356.
Really?
This is significant because now this takes your documented history all the way back to the 6th century.
Well, I wanted to know next. So you got me to 1204. How do you get me back to the 6th century?
Yeah, because this cloth with an image on, in fact, after the crusade of the Fourth Crusade, a letter was written to Pope Innocent III, kind of protesting this whole thing. Even though the Pope had not ordered this crusade to happen, he had no intention of it going to Constantinople in the first place. This letter of protest was written, and in it, it talks about how the Venetians, troops of Venice, had stolen the city blind of all the gold, silver, and ivory, and the French did the same with the relics of the saints, and it lists everything. And at the very end of this letter, it says, and most sacred of all, the linen in which our Lord Jesus Christ was wrapped after his death and before his resurrection. The linen cloth was in Constantinople in 1204 and was considered the most sacred and holy of all of the relics. That's what disappeared, and that cloth goes all the way back to the year 544 when it was kind of rediscovered in Edessa, Turkey. And at that point in time, it becomes known as the image of Edessa, the image not made by hands. And this is the very image of which all of your Orthodox icons are based on.
So the claim then is that the image of Edessa is the same as the Shroud of Turin.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And then there is legend and folklore that kind of brings it all the way back to the legend of Abgar, who was the king of the city state of Edessa during the first century. And according to the legend, he was dying of leprosy and sent a messenger off to ask Jesus to come to Edessa to bring healing to him. Well, obviously Jesus had a different plan, but then something, after Jesus died and rose again from the dead, maybe a few years later, Jude Thaddeus, one of the 70 disciples, brought a cloth with an image on it to Edessa. And guess what? King Abgar is healed of leprosy, becomes a Christian, and in fact, the first church outside the Holy Land is actually recorded to have been built in the early second century. So it's not pure history, but it's a very interesting legend that kind of ties it all together.
Yeah, well, it gives us something to continue to pursue. It keeps the story coherent.
Absolutely.
Now, what does the Sudarium of Oviedo show regarding the relationship to the shroud?
The Sudarium of Oviedo shows this is about a 4 foot by 2.5 feet wide cloth. It is covered with blood stains and also pleural fluid. and it was in the bloodstain patterns on the Sudario Bovieto have about a 94% correlation with the bloodstains that we see on the shroud, and so we're pretty certain that they are one and the same. And in fact, you know, in the Gospel of John, it talks about that there is the sindon, which is the long linen shroud, and the sudarium that is in
right.
the tomb in its own place. Now, what we think how that was used was that when Jesus was on the cross, prior to they were able to get permission from Pilate to remove him from the cross, after he died, they wrapped this cloth around his face, around his head, so that people wouldn't have to see Jesus, you know, hanging on the cross and seeing his dead eyes and face and all that. So. And you know, today, if someone passes away, the first thing you do is pull the sheet up over the head, and that's exactly what they did then. And
yeah.
so once the body was actually removed and laid in the shroud, that cloth was then removed from around his face, and probably one of the theories is just kind of balled up and put at the top of the head. And so at the time the image was made, it was not over his face at that time. It was actually removed, you know, prior to being wrapped in the shroud.
I'm wondering, are we able to do any DNA tracing on artifacts?
Well, some DNA was done by a microbiologist in San Antonio, and it is human DNA, but that's as far as it goes. In fact, the church was very firm that they did not want any DNA testing done on this, because I think, you know, you know there are a lot of fiction books out there about someone cloning Jesus based on the blood on the shroud. So say, nuh-uh, we don't want to go that far.
While we're talking about odd conspiracy theories, is there any link between the Holy Grail and the Shroud of Turin?
Well, that's very fascinating. If anyone should go to Stroud University, go to the School of History, there's a professor, his name is Dr. Dan Scavone, and he's done some fascinating historical research to indicate that, believe it or not, what we know as the Shroud of Turin is in fact the same as the Holy Grail. You believe that?
No, I don't know. Tell me.
Well, interesting. No one knows what the word grail means. Ask anyone. Now, we just assume that it means the cup, okay? That's not what it means, because there are in all of the earliest legends of the grail legends, it's described as a platter that contains the blood. Well, you know, it's interesting. All these Grail legends go back to an apocryphal work called the Gospel of Thomas, and in the Gospel of Thomas, it has the story of Joseph of Arimathea going up to Jesus, who's hanging on the cross, and collecting his blood that is kind of dripping from his side. In the Grail legends, it says that he collects the blood in the cup. That's not what the Gospel of Thomas says. The Gospel of Thomas says he collected the blood in the shroud.
Huh.
And then all of these myths around the Holy Grail later say, well, that doesn't make any sense. It must have been the cup.
Huh.
Well, in the word grail, we get the word gradual. Now, in Constantinople, there was a period of time for I don't know exactly how long, but we can see under special kind of photography on the shroud, we can see a pattern of folds indicating how the shroud was exhibited, and it was kept in a box, and it was used as a liturgical device, we think, on Good Friday and Easter Sunday, where it was kind of raised up a couple feet, and that represented Jesus as a child. Raised up a couple more feet, Jesus as an adolescent. A few more feet, Jesus as a man, all the way up to you have the full figure of the shroud, Jesus the crucified Lord. So it went through four different stages. And so this is this gradual unfolding of the shroud image, and Dan Scavone makes an excellent case that this is one and the same as the Shroud of Turin. Now here's the real link why this confusion exists. Mm-hmm. In all of the Grail legends, they're searching for the Grail where? In Britain, right? In mm-hmm. Great Britain. But that is a translation error. Because remember the Shroud was originally in Edessa, and the main city and the main part of the city of Edessa is called the Britium of Edessa.
Hmm.
And so Scavone believes that this is simply a translation error. That
isn't it something.
Somehow they translated Britium to Britain.
Yeah, yeah.
Huh. And so that's... it's very interesting. But there is videos and stuff that are on the website where Scavone talks about all this. And it's very, very fascinating.
Let me. We've just got about 2 minutes left. And
sure.
Is it still accepted that there's botanical evidence related to the Shroud which indicates that it originated in Israel?
Oh yeah, there is clearly much pollen that is on the Shroud. There are also off-body flower images that are on the Shroud. I mean, Dr. Avinoam Danin, who is a botanist, he is Jewish. He is a professor at the Hebrew University. He's written 7 books on the flora of Palestine. He's on record saying this cloth originated in Israel based on
wow.
botanical evidence.
Russ, great talking with you. And again, it's shrouduniversity.com. It's a fascinating website. You can ask questions and do research in 10 different areas, discipline. And we'll make sure, Russ, that it's linked at our website as well. Thank you.
Perfect. Thank you.
I'm Al Cresta.
From Shroud University, this is Russ Brialt. I hope you've enjoyed today's podcast, and we hope you stop back from time to time and see what else is new. Also, check out Shroud University itself with all kinds of videos, audios, video blogs, and pretty much everything you can think of related to the Shroud of Turin, the greatest mystery in the known world.